The headlines: North Korea fires 10 missiles, including one that lands close to South Korea's waters. Seoul says it moves effectively a territorial invasion. Israeli forces kill a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank following an alleged car ramming and stabbing attack. Plus, Ukraine's President Zelensky urges a firm response to Russia's disruption of grain exports while Putin demands guarantees before rejoining the grain deal. Hello and welcome, everybody. The situation on the Korean Peninsula appears to be growing more unstable. For the first time in decades, North and South Korea have fired missiles landing in waters off each other's coasts. The South has launched three air-to-ground missiles and closed some of its air routes off the East Coast. Seoul says the move was in response to Pyongyang firing at least 10 missiles of various types earlier. One of the missiles landed close to South Korean waters. Seoul now says that North Korea also fired more than 100 artillery rounds into the maritime buffer zone hours later. Separately, one of the missiles fired by Pyongyang landed outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. Both countries have reacted. South Korea's President Yoon Suk-yeol says the move amounts to a territorial invasion, while Japan's defense minister has called it an intolerable move.
We will work closely with relevant countries, including the United States and South Korea, and we are determined to firmly protect our people's lives and peaceful livelihoods. Based on this situation, we will consider all options realistically without excluding anything, including counterattack capability, and continue to work on strengthening our defense capabilities fundamentally.
The U.S. and South Korea are conducting their largest ever air drills. The exercises began on Monday and will end Friday, just hours ahead of its latest missile launches. Pyongyang called for a halt to the joint drills by Washington and Seoul, which it sees as an existential threat and proof of their hostility. From Seoul, Frank Smith explains why the sanctions against North Korea remain a core issue in resolving this conflict.
The U.S. has suggested that they would hold so-called unconditional talks with North Korea. But one of the conditions, the primary condition of any negotiations with North Korea on the part of the U.S. and South Korea, is that the sanctions, the United Nations Security Council sanctions, really led by the United States, remain in place. And those sanctions prevent North Korea really from engaging in trade with the international community. North Korea has indicated previously it wants to see those sanctions lifted. It wants to see what it sees as a hostile policy toward Pyongyang really changed. But it hasn't seen that, despite a two-year-long moratorium on North Korea long-range missile testing and nuclear testing. Those commitments on the part of North Korea really have elapsed now, especially with the turn and the hard line here with conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea.
Well, this just in, Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian man in Ramallah. We're now going live to the city in the occupied West Bank, where our correspondent Mona Kandil is ready to give us the latest updates. Mona, what details do you have to share with us?
The incident happened at one of the Israeli military checkpoints west Ramallah Beit'ur checkpoint. It seems that a Palestinian arrived with his vehicle at one of the Israeli military checkpoints and rammed his vehicle into a group of soldiers standing at the checkpoint. There was a video published by the Israeli military claiming that it was not an incident, it was a vehicle ramming attack. We are speaking about a Palestinian man, an old Palestinian man. He was shot by the Israeli soldiers there, and immediately the Israeli military said that he was shot dead. We are speaking about Habes Rayyan from the village of Bedokpo, 54 years old.
All right, thanks a lot. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, Israel's former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will likely return to power as exit polls give his right-wing Likud party a narrow lead in parliamentary elections. Exit polls suggest Likud managed to secure 61 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Yair Lapid's Yesh Atid party garnered 54 seats. Right-wing firebrand Itamar Ben-Gavir and his religious Zionism bloc is ranked third in the vote. The final results are expected later in the week and may differ from the initial results. That's because it's not clear if Ben-Gavir supports Netanyahu in the vote. This is Israel's fifth election in less than 4 years. Reacting to Israel's election results, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya said they prove growing extremism and racism in Israeli society. Wassel Abu Youssef, a Palestine Liberation Organization official, also said Netanyahu's slim victory in exit polls shows Israel is becoming more rightist and extreme. Well, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran says Washington will resort to military action, if necessary, to prevent the Islamic Republic from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Now, there are other tools, sanctions, pressure, and yes, as the president has said, if all other means fail as a last resort, he would keep the military option very clearly on the table if that's what it would take to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
Mali has dialed up anti-Iran rhetoric and military threat while speaking at an event organized by an American think tank, Carnegie Endowment. He clarified that there has been no movement on Washington rejoining the Iran nuclear deal since late August or early September. He said the U.S. will not waste time on the deal if nothing is going to happen. The 2015 deal, known also as the JCPOA, or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was left in tatters after the U.S. withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in April last year between Iran and the remaining signatories. However, the talks were stalled, rather, over what Iran called U.S. excessive demands. Political analyst Fouad Izadi says U.S.'s military threat against Iran or any other country is against international law.
He's an American official, so he's under the influence of American arrogance. He thinks by threatening Iran, he can achieve foreign policy goals. You know, it's actually illegal under the UN Charter to threaten other countries. The article talks about the use of force. It's illegal to use force against other countries. If the UN Security Council hasn't approved that use of force. But the sentence says threat or use of force. So threatening other countries is against international law. But we are talking about the U.S. government officials. They break international law every day. And they're showing their true face when it comes to Iran. So this is against international law. It's also against the Algiers Accord. The first article of Algiers Accord says that the U.S. Will not interfere in internal affairs of Iran. And they have been violating that accord since its beginning. And we are used to this type of American behavior in Iran, so there's nothing surprising here.
Iran slapped sanctions on 10 American officials and 4 entities over human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Here are some of these blacklisted individuals.
General Michael Eric Kurilla, commander of U.S. Central Command. Lieutenant General Gregory Gillett, deputy commander of U.S. Central Command. Scott Dozermu, commander of U.S. Airbase in Erbil. Anne Neuberger, deputy national security advisor for cyber and emerging technology. Major General Isaac Johnson, Jr., commander of U.S. Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command.
Iran's foreign ministry says the targeted individuals and entities interfered in Iran's internal affairs, instigated violence and riots in the country, and committed economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Those on the blacklist include the U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. and its Western allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran over what they called a crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran dismisses the allegation, saying that it was dealing with foreign-backed rioters. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says the grain shipping corridor to get food out of the country needs reliable long-term protection. Zelensky also said that Russia must realize it will receive a harsh global response to any measures disrupting food exports. That came after Russian President Vladimir Putin called on Ukraine to guarantee the safety of Black Sea traffic. Moscow has suspended participation in a UN-brokered grain shipment deal. It cited a Ukrainian drone attack on Russian ships in Crimea. Kiev has dismissed the allegation as a false pretext. Russia has called on the UN to obtain the required guarantees from Ukraine. And the political stalemate in Northern Ireland caused by the UK's withdrawal from the European Union drags on. The country's political parties missed a legal deadline for the formation of a power-sharing government following an election in May that put Sinn Féin nationalists in power for the first time. And in the absence of a government, the devolved nation now looks on course for another poll. All this among a punishing cost of living and energy crisis. Saeed Puruza has this report.
The Northern Ireland Parliament buildings, the Storma, the cornerstone of the Good Friday Agreement, not functioning properly for months. A last-ditch attempt last week to elect a speaker and former power-sharing government fell through. First Minister-designate Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill did not mince her words.
Geoffrey Donaldson and the DUP have left us all at the mercy of the heartless and dysfunctional Tory government, whose own survival is all that ever counts. The Tories care less for the consequences of their dire policy decisions and their political choices on the lives of workers and families here.
The unionists who want Northern Ireland to remain part of the UK say they won't enter power sharing unless the Northern Ireland Protocol is scrapped.
It is about unionists feeling that they have been made second-class citizens as a result of a protocol that diminishes and undermines our place in the United Kingdom.
The problem he's talking about lies in these dark blue waters.
This is the Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it, but to the EU, that is anathema.
The EU has proposed ways to make the protocol work, but they were turned down by the UK government, which has vowed unilateral action. But while the unionists say this is all about their position in the UK, others say there is more to the story.
The protocol, if we want to be real about it, actually benefits people here in the north of Ireland because we get the benefits of both the EU market and, of course, what has happened after Brexit. But what has happened is that unionists have used the protocol as a ruse because they do not want to share power with a nationalist Republican First Minister. This is what this is really about.
There is the political theater at Stormont and Westminster, and there is the reality for those grappling with the cost of living and energy crisis induced by Brexit and the Western-backed war in Ukraine.
What we need is a functioning government to make economic decisions and get some money out of those areas that really need it badly. I think we're in for a long winter, and if this impasse continues, it's going to be a very, very difficult few months for people that live here, yeah.
Unless there is compromise, it's difficult to see what another election costing £6.5 million will achieve, because the protocol problem will still exist, and so will the threat to the Good Friday Agreement. Saeed Puruza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Colombia and Venezuela pressing the reset button on their relations, with the Colombian president paying a rare visit to Caracas. Gustavo Petro and his Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have held their first meeting since the neighbors restored diplomatic ties after a three-year break. The two presidents have discussed a range of issues, including trade relations. Meanwhile, Petro has called for Venezuela's reintegration into a regional human rights system and a trade alliance. The neighbors broke off diplomatic relations in 2019 over political tensions between Caracas and the previous governments in Bogota. Petro's visit is the first by a Colombian president to Venezuela in nearly a decade. And as the United States nears a national voting day, a feeling of chaos is being widely reported. A rather shocking new poll shows that 4 out of 5 people believe the country is already out of control. Rami Mazzuri has more from Chicago.
The United States has entered its last week before the midterm legislative vote and tensions are starting to escalate. The Republicans appear certain to win the lower House of Representatives and need to win only one of four now neck-and-neck races to also control the upper Senate. Some Democrats have called the polls Republican propaganda, further undermining confidence in their predictions and creating more uncertainty.
I think it should just be positive. It's very hard to decide what is the truth and what isn't. You get the one candidate, and then the next candidate says everything that the first candidate said is wrong on the commercial. We've started muting them.
Perhaps the most telling poll is one which showed that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the country is out of control. Many say there's no lack of reasons for such a perception. The specter of a divided and thus ineffective federal government, record inflation, a prolonged drug epidemic, regular mass shootings, a likely double-dip recession, fear-mongering about war with Russia over Ukraine or with China over Taiwan, a cultural war over identity politics, and more.
Perception is reality, right? So, when we see the political attacks that have happened on both sides, it kind of gives that impression. I think the media can feed into that at times as well. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of where we're at, unfortunately.
The recent in-home attack on the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who holds the number three post in the American system, has become embroiled in salacious controversy. Similar to the Hunter Biden laptop affair in the autumn of 2020, the case is dominating the pre-vote headlines and producing partisan allegations of either misinformation or a cover-up. Since 2017, the number of investigated threats against Washington's lawmakers has tripled. Perhaps the biggest problem in the United States hasn't even occurred yet, the near certainty of disputed election results. Some tight Senate races may require runoff votes, meaning the final outcome will likely be controversial for weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we look at how Western governments have tried to portray the Islamic Republic of Iran as anti-women's rights. We also take a look at the esteemed position of women within Islamic societies and within Islam, as well as the status of women and how women are treated in Western societies. Please stay with us. According to Islamic teachings, there is no difference between men and women, and both have been endowed with intelligence and human dignity. According to Islam, men and women complement one another, and they complete each other. Both men and women can help each other to grow and to evolve. Both of them are central planks of society and family. The Holy Quran teaches us that the value of each human being, both men and women, lies in their piety and abstinence from doing wrong and from sinful behavior. According to the Holy Quran, men and women who are more pious are closer to God and more valued by God. Compare and contrast this with what some famous Western philosophers and intellectuals have said about women. Philosophers and intellectuals like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Immanuel Kant, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Arthur Schopenhauer, among others, have seriously argued that women are inferior to men. The German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer's opinion about women is quite degrading. In his essay on women, Schopenhauer tries to demonstrate the inferiority of women. Arthur Schopenhauer, who remained celibate throughout his life, once said, "Women have no talent or ability in poetry, music, and the fine arts. If women claim to excel in these arts, that is just wishful thinking on their part, and it's ludicrous." Arthur Schopenhauer believed that women are incapable of undertaking hard physical or mental work, and that they should concentrate on their children's upbringing and obeying what their husbands tell them to do. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, the German philosopher and cultural critic who had a profound influence on modern intellectual history, seriously argued that women are animals with long hair and deficient minds. Immanuel Kant was one of the most notable European thinkers to defend racism, and some have claimed that he was one of the central figures in the birth of modern scientific racism. Immanuel Kant believed that women did not have any citizens' rights, and that women belonged to men or were possessed by men. Given this background of Western thinkers and philosophers, and the fact that the sex industry in Europe and America has shamefully exploited and denigrated women for many decades, it seems obvious that the West does not have the moral high ground to preach any country about women's rights and women's freedom. Western countries know very well that women in the Islamic Republic of Iran are not treated as sexual objects or exploited unfairly. They know very well that the Iranian women play their full role in society and have achieved great successes in all manner of disciplines. Women in the Islamic Republic of Iran play a very important role in scientific and technological research, in universities and academia, in businesses and the high street, in the economy, in industry, and export of goods and services. Women's presence in Iranian industry and business, in academia and research, in companies and firms both large and small, is conspicuous and prominent. Wearing the hijab has not been a hindrance in any way for Iranian women, who have shown their success and excelled in all manner of fields. Despite all this evidence, Western governments have been determined to portray the Islamic Republic of Iran as anti-women's rights. There has been a long-standing Western media campaign to depict Islam and the Islamic Republic as suppressing women and being opposed to women's rights. Western academics, Western journalists, writers, and media have persistently tried to suggest that the hijab has held back Iranian women. but they have not come up with a cogent, logical and convincing argument as to why Iranian women have excelled and thrived in university research, in businesses and in industry. Westerners simply have no credible explanation for this fact. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has always emphasized that the West should be held accountable and should answer with regards to mistreatment of women in Western societies. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, they certainly owe us an explanation. Commenting on the empty slogan of freedom for women, the leader poignantly said, "What is really meant by women's freedom in the West is that scantily clad women are on public display, often through the media, so that the male population can derive some pleasure from this. Women are used to sexually excite men. In the decaying and decadent Western culture, freedom for women is really a euphemism for exploitation of women and treating them as sexual objects." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei further added, "See women as dignified human beings, and then it becomes clear what is women's rights and what is freedom for women. See women as central players in proper upbringing of children, and women's rights and freedom will then become clear. See women as the most vital part of a family unit. Even though men and women both make up the family unit and both play a role in its maintenance, it is women who establish comfort, warmth, and calm at home, giving home a truly homely feel. From this perspective, it becomes clear what is women's rights and what is their freedom." We cannot claim with certainty that all the rights of women, as enshrined in Islam, have been afforded to them in Islamic societies. But what we can say with certainty is that women in Western societies are grappling with much more complex issues in trying to defend and reclaim their basic rights. Within Islamic Iran, women play a central role in families as wives and mothers. Their kindness and love brings peace and calm to the family setting. And equally importantly, they play a central role in the upbringing of children. Women ensure that children are taught everything they need to know, and they grow up to be responsible, caring and useful members of society. This is the most substantial and valuable contribution of women to society. Iranian women, just like Iranian men, have an esteemed position and esteemed status within society, and their rights are well defined and known to all. Western governments have tried to put pressure on Iran through the issue of Islamic hijab, but this pressure will invariably fail to halt or to hinder the progress and advancement of Iran's Muslim women, who have firm faith in their religion and always observe the hijab.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The assault of top Democrat Nancy Pelosi's husband at their home has raised concerns that the U.S. could experience political violence right before the U.S. midterm elections. Why would there be an assault on the U.S. House Speaker's husband in the first place? Political polarity in the U.S. is so severe, at least that's how it's been reported, that most Americans think that the U.S. will actually have more political violence overall, leading to it to be less of a democracy. How the U.S. got to this mess and whether it can grow out of this political polarity is the topic of this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests for this program. Activist and commentator Don DeBart joins us from Ossining, New York. And journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us also from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I'll first start with you. What reaction did you have when you heard about this incident where it's been described as a follower of right-wing conspiracy theories who wanted to kidnap Nancy Pelosi but went for her husband instead since she wasn't home and hit him with an axe, resulting in skull fractures and injuries to his hand and right arm?
It was not an axe, it was a hammer. But there are still a lot of questions outstanding about this story. We're not really quite sure what took place. The police accounts have not been very good, but it seems that Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, a very wealthy businessman, was attacked by someone who doesn't like Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is third-ranking person in the U.S. government, just behind the president and vice president. She's the Speaker of the House, and she draws a lot of hostility from Republicans, essentially. So tensions are very high. The elections are just 6 days off at this point. And there's a feeling of violence in the air.
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to figure out in this program, if we can, how it got to this point. Now, Don DeBart, what we're looking at over here is Nancy Pelosi herself, as our guest there from New York said. She has been actually a topic for the Republicans, it appears. Her office was ransacked during the insurrection, and they were looking for her during the melee, as it was described. Why has she been such a target for Republicans based on what we're seeing here in terms of information out there?
Well, I hope, first of all, when you're using the term insurrection, you're putting it in quotes. That's what it's referred to as by some here, almost wall-to-wall the media. There was a protest march, and some rioters entered the Capitol building, sat down for a while. One of them got shot in the face and killed. This is really not distinguishable from occupations of various Capitol buildings by Democratic supporters and Republican supporters, for example, in Wisconsin. The context for this, A-Trap Brown said back in the late 1960s, violence is as American as apple pie. And he wasn't being glib. He was being a journalist, actually, reporting the history, or an historian.
How long ago?
The history of the United States. Polling data, if you go back, if you want to take some of the charge out of it, start back in 2014 and back, before Trump was a candidate, and suddenly his candidacy was a marker of fascism and violence and whatnot. Even then, the United States voting population and just the people generally were completely divided into two camps, two cohorts. that believe that the other or the party that they support is the root of all evil. These are very hard, ideological positions, and it's kind of weird calling them ideological because the fundamental ideology is almost identical. But this is a fact, and this is something that gets excited by politicians in the United States, so that the unanimity of their opinion on major policy, like, gee, should we have a war with Russia, or should we sanction Iran, or should we sanction Cuba? Those things never come on the table. These two groups are encouraged to fight with each other over things that are of much mm-hmm. lesser import.
But trying to get from the point where Nancy Pelosi is being targeted, Daniel Lazar, and then this gentleman or man shows up at the doorstep with, thank you for correcting me, with a hammer, even though the details are murky, as you said, and then he attacks her husband, even though it was said that he wanted to take her as a hostage and he was going to break her bones, from what we understand. Again, I know the details are murky. How we get in the States from that to this? She's being targeted politically, but then how do you get to someone going out with that intention, which involves violence?
Well, first of all, the January 6th, 2021 riot was really an insurrection. It had the goal of overturning the election results. Joe Biden, like him or not, had won by more than 7 million votes, but Trump and his supporters were determined to overthrow the election, to throw the contest into the House, and essentially stage a coup d'etat. That's what happened. Now, the American system is breaking down. It's 235 years old. We've had gridlock, in other words, utter paralysis at the congressional level for actually close to 40 years at this point. Maybe 30 years is a better estimate. Government is paralyzed. Passions are rising. There's a growing sense of civil war in the air. And remember, this happened before the 1860s, sure, where Americans had a civil war. Roughly 2.5% of the population died in that conflict. An entire region was laid waste. It was a massive conflict, one of the greatest wars of the 19th century. After the Napoleonic period, I should add. There's no doubt that things are coming apart. This ancient constitutional system is disintegrating before our eyes, and there really is no way out of the problem. So okay, therefore, people are worried that therefore the coming elections will lead to a further increase in violence. And mm-hmm. although the details are murky, as you say, it appears that the attack on Pelosi's husband was an example of this rising tide of violence, this deepening breakdown.
Okay, Don DeBar, go ahead.
I can't get past I don't want to litigate this issue for the whole program, but it's absurd to term this an insurrection and to certainly say that it was an intended coup d'etat. Let's say that this group of people, led by the guy with the horns and whoever else was among their group, were able to hold the Capitol building, say, for a month or a year. Does anyone imagine that they thought, from there, using Pelosi's phone, they could call the Pentagon and order a drone strike, or they could call the Office of Budget Management and have someone budget something for them, a limousine or lunch or whatever, or that they could call IRS and have them issue a check to someone? What exactly was the mechanism that was going to be used to seize power besides occupying the Capitol building? It's not just irresponsible, it's almost infantile to refer to it this way. And I don't mean anything personal to Dan, but that to me, that doesn't make any sense at all. You can't think this thing one sentence forward and hold that that's what it was. Now, given that, the situation in this country is more or less a media show. These individual incidents are characterized across a broad, basically a broad set of outputs that go into the brain of every person in the country, characterizing them in one fashion or another and inflaming these emotional, you know, reservoirs that exist among two groups of people who watch media either MSNBC style or Fox style, where this is stoked on a constant basis. The guy himself is clearly a lunatic, okay? They did a jailhouse interview with his wife, who's in prison for 20 years for trying to kidnap a 14-year-old boy. This guy, there's allegations of him molesting his children. She says that he thought he was Jesus Christ for 6 months or whatever. This is not a marker, I hope it's not a marker, of the body politic in the United States or of the followers or adherence to any particular political grouping in the United States. This is a nut job that got his hands on a hammer, and whether he was invited in by Paul Pelosi, which is also one of the sets of allegations out here that's, you know, unproven or not, or broke in through security. That how do you not have security for the person third in line for the presidency, where somebody can just bust in the house at 2 o'clock in the morning? Whatever that was, it's not an indication that there's a group of people that are looking to seize the government in the United States, and that we have to somehow legislate ourselves, and what I hear Dan saying, maybe revise the Constitution in order to protect ourselves.
All right. The thing we're getting at over here is, Daniel Lazar, is the fact that there is this thing called political violence. And but the thing is this. Many perhaps are not aware that political violence is not just something that perhaps is somewhat on the surface, or maybe it's a one-off. Or, I mean, when you talk about it in the context of the U.S., it was quite shocking to see how that is actually something that has been going on for quite some time. Of course, it's been really highlighted based on Trump's tenure, and of course all the different reasons there, the biggest one being the fact that he didn't accept the election results. Now, what's more shocking are the way that the parties are dealing with, in particular, Democrats and Republicans. And I'm going to go by polls because I don't have anything else to go by to make the point here. One of them talks about the use of threats. This was in Carnegie that was mentioned. By February 2021, 25% of Republicans and 17% of Democrats felt threats against the other party's leaders were justifiable. 19% of Republicans and 10% of Democrats believe it was justified to harass ordinary members of the other party. When I read this off to you, does this sound like it's something you believe? I mean, is this credible based on what I just read?
Well, it's entirely credible. Those are the perceptions out there. Listen, I don't want to get into an extended debate over what happened in 2021, but the goal was to stop the certification of the 2020 election results and thereby throw the contest into the House of Representatives, where the Republicans essentially have an advantage due to rules dating from the early 19th century. And so it was not an unrealistic strategy, and if the coup had succeeded, Donald Trump would have been declared president by the House of Representatives. And he might have taken office, but it certainly would have thrown things into turmoil. But political violence happens when political structures break down. When things are working smoothly, when you have free elections, when you have a party system, you have a parliament that is well functioning, et cetera, then people, you know, people resolve their differences in a peaceful, civilized manner. That's the way it works. I mean, Britain has gone through three prime ministers in a matter of months, but there has been no fighting in the streets. I mean, it doesn't reflect very well on the British system. Has attacked one another. No one has made threats. There's no the political mechanisms are moving forward in a, you know, smoothly okay. And efficiently. But in America, they're not. In America, they're falling apart. They're seizing up. They're freezing up.
Sure.
And they've been frozen for the last 30 years.
Hold on to that thought. Hold on to that thought, because I'd like to get Don DeBar before he shakes his head more to answer you. Don DeBar, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just a point of clarification on the process that was underway on January 6, 2021. In the joint session, what happens essentially is a roll call of the votes from each of the states on their electors and how they were to be apportioned, and what had been certified by the state, submitted to the joint house for them to vote on whether or not to accept it. In each case, If you have one member of the House and one member of the Senate raise an objection, this then forces the two houses to separate, go back to their respective chambers, and have a trial of fact based on the allegations that there was this problem or that problem. In fact, beginning with the A's, that process was begun, and that was when the Capitol was breached. That postponed the trial of facts that would have taken place, and it had been announced was going to take place on five other states, all of the swing states. There were questions that the ballots that were done by hand that were added to the methodology used for conducting elections in the year 2020 were not valid because they had not been authorized by the state legislature as is required under the U.S. Constitution. And as we know, those ballots were counted late, and they swung the election for Biden. What the people who were bringing these challenges hoped to do was to have a public trial of fact on television in each case, so that no matter what happened, they either scored their political points or they actually changed the outcome of the election under the due process of the Constitution.
Okay.
Now, the reality is the Republicans did not have a majority in the House of Representatives. So their strategy was not to throw it to the House thinking they were going to get Trump elected.
Could I interrupt?
Go ahead, sure.
The rules set forth in the 12th Amendment, which date from 1803, says the House would vote by state delegations. And the Republicans have a majority of state delegations in the House.
Pennsylvania.
So that's what I meant by the idea of the Republicans having an advantage. If they succeeded in throwing it to the House, they would have won. Donald Trump would have been installed in the White House for a second term. That was the goal of
So let's try to get beyond this point here. And I have to, sure. Daniel Azar, thank you for that. But I'd like to go to Don DeBar and ask him this, because I asked you, Daniel Azar, about the threats that were thrown by both parties. Don DeBar, what we have here, based on this finding again, where it summed up the idea, the notion of threats, it said one in five Republicans, 20%, and 13% of Democrats claimed that political violence was justified these days. And it put "these days" in quotes. And let me actually give you the source, so I don't just talk.
I've seen these studies.
This came the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is where the source of this was. Now, what's interesting here is the fact that they think political violence is okay, and then they say that this is and then the Republicans stand out more compared to the Democrats. Why are the Republicans standing out more when it comes to the use of political violence, first of all? And second of all, why is that even, this political violence, being justified?
Well, first of all, if you look closely at the study, the margin of error actually consumes a lot of the difference between the two. And, you know, right now the Republicans are out of power. You know, there's probably a deeper sense of frustration. If you go back to the time that Trump was president, the numbers were actually not quite so far apart. And if you look at, for example, things that happened around, say, the nomination of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and the protests that were outside of his house and some of the other things, you know, there's been all kinds of political violence and sort of, you know, it's kind of unfocused. It gathers around individual, you know, incidents in the political realm, but it's not really a whole ideology that holds it together, where this is going to be the ideology of a revolutionary force that's going to change society. It's more on the order of riots. And here's the real thing. You know, we're talking about, for example, this incident with Pelosi's husband, which is, you know, as regrettable as it is, as, you know, horrible as it is, I'm sure, for their family. Nancy Pelosi has funded for Ukraine alone, since 2014, billions and billions and billions of dollars, which have resulted in tens of thousands of people dying in political violence. You know, the scale of these incidents in the United States compared to the imposition of political violence on the world by these same political officials, it's too ridiculous for words to look at them together.
Sure. I'm going to move on, since I'm looking at the clock and there are just a few minutes left here. Daniel Azar, again, I'm sorry to go by polls, but I'm trying to make a point, and I'm using the polls to come across here. The one was about threats. This is about the use of violence, where within the context of this source, do you believe the use of violence to take over state government buildings? to advance your political goals is justified. Republicans, 13%, a quarter of the Republicans, and 13% of Democrats agreed. Okay? And then here comes what was shocking. 12% of Republicans and 11% of Democrats agreed that the assassination, in quotes, the assassination of opposing political leaders is justified to advance political goals. Does that sound like something that is believable, first of all? I mean, is that really what we're looking at in the political environment in the U.S.?
Yeah, those numbers sound correct. I think that's what I'm sure the poll was honest and accurate. I'm sure the people answered that way. And all I can say again is that the political machinery is breaking down. And when it breaks down, people don't have any legal constitutional recourse to battle these things out. They have no way of winning an argument, winning a debate, winning an election. So if the electoral process is stalled or broken, people have no choice but to fight it out in the streets. And that means violence, and that means assassination, and all
okay,
the rest.
Don DeBar, do you agree with that?
Yeah, and I'll point to something that illustrates it, I think, pretty clearly. For many years, polling data shows Congress somewhere between 8 and 20% favorable ratings among voters. And yet, the members of Congress have had for many years now in excess of a 95% reelection rate, which shows you that there is definitely a problem with the electoral system because it does not produce the outcomes that people hope. And in fact, most likely, I mean, that you can only conclude, doesn't give them choices to change the situation that they're unhappy with.
So you mean that there should be more political parties? Is that what you're saying? That maybe that's one way of going about it?
I don't know what the mechanism is. I can tell you from my own experience running for office, that the system, the Trump contaminates the word by using it, but the system is clearly rigged. Anyone involved in it knows it. The people who administer the system are appointed by people that are gatekeepers for who the candidates are. Policy decisions are made by a very small group of people who then put candidates on the ballot and in office by consensus. And voters have really little to do with it other than to vote on which one that they want that's going to have a war with Russia and China or whatever, for example.
Right.
But how do they feel about abortion? How do they feel about gay marriage?
Okay.
You know, how do they feel about other issues that don't go to the heart of some of these really big issues?
All right. So down to the wire here. I want to ask you, Daniel Azar, what you know about Marjorie Taylor Greene, because I'm looking at how, for example, she has repeatedly suggested support for Pelosi's execution and has, among that of other prominent Democrats, liked a Facebook post that said a bullet to the head would be the most expedient way to end Pelosi's speakership. I mean, is that what we're looking at when it comes to the real sentiment here? And how that can translate into action by people who, Americans who are looking up to these lawmakers who are setting the laws?
Yes, 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 1,000 times yes. I mean, the system, again, is breaking down. Listen, the basic problem is that we have a 235-year-old system which is completely unchangeable, frozen in place. It can't be altered in the slightest, okay? The whole amending process is completely inadequate, completely frozen. It can't be changed. It's amazing. It dates from the age of powdered wigs and silk knee breeches, yet America is still stuck in the distant past. So all kinds of ugly passions, fascist tendencies are rising to the surface. This is unquestionably happening. But the problem is, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time.
No, we're just fresh out of time. I'm going to suggest having another program on this topic.
Sounds great.
Because we can get at least more of Don DeBar in there also. But thank you both for your contribution. Don DeBar from Usening, New York, activist and commentator, and Daniel Azar from New York, also journalist and author. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. We find many proofs for the great treasure of his knowledge and wisdom. One of the great proofs of the great treasure of knowledge and wisdom of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is that while His Eminence was still in his tender youth, the Shia jurisprudence, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, hastened towards the city of Medina. They came to inquire as to know who is the next infallible and divinely appointed Imam. The reliable people and those who were trustworthy guided these Shia jurisprudents who had come from different places in the Islamic world towards Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. The Shia jurisprudents went to Imam al-Jawad and asked His Eminence the most ambiguous and complicated of questions. And yet Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every one of them.
Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam stated, "It is sufficient for someone to be classified as a betrayer if he is the trustee of a disloyal person."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the golden dialogues, the beautiful dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, of course, the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, was the son of the eighth divinely appointed Imam,